This Labor Day weekend on Art of the Air, we feature new mystery author Olivia Raymond with her debut novel, Deadly Secrets from Pond Island. Next, we speak with African-American contemporary realism and figurative narrative artist Afi Essay. Our spotlight is in LaPorte County Symphony's 18th annual Hoosier Star, happening September 9th.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, and WDSO 88.3 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org, and Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on WDSO 88.3 FM. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. I'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight from the Hoosier Star, which is the LaPorte County Symphony, the new executive director who we've talked to before, Emily Yannis. Welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Esther. Thanks, Larry.
Well, now starting a whole brand new season. Is this the 50th or 51st season we're starting?
This is the 51st season. Yes, very exciting. Opens with Hoosier Star on September 9th.
Well, tell our audience who may not ever know anything about the Hoosier Star event, maybe explain what that's about. I mean, it's been running for, quite a few years now, hasn't it?
I believe this is its 18th year. It began kind of as an outpouring of the American Idol craze that happened, you know, in the early to mid 2000s. And it has become a mainstay of our organization's season. And so in February and March, we had auditions for the finalists. So five youth division finalists and five adult division finalists are chosen from that pool of auditioners. And we have some really fantastic finalists this year from seven different areas in the region. We have LaPorte, Elkhart, Buchanan, Michigan, Hobart, Griffith, Michigan City, and South Bend. And so they will compete on Saturday, September 9th for a live audience, also live streamed, who can vote for their favorite, who they think should be the winner of Hoosier Star. And of course, they're accompanied by our fantastic LCSO Symphony.
Well, I'm so glad you have that live stream function as well, really.
Yeah, I think that was born out of the pandemic, but has remained because people loved it so much, you know, because then people can watch and vote from afar. And I believe we've had people from other continents even tuning in. So it's exciting. I know.
It's an exciting evening in person or live stream.
How many people do you have in each category? I know you have a youth category and an adult category. And so you narrowed, how many people auditioned? And then how's that narrowed down to what you have left for the actual?
Yeah, that's right. We receive a lot of inquiries. Auditions, I'm not exactly sure. Since just coming onto the position in June, I wasn't present for the auditions in February and March. But I know that it's a multi-day process for the audition. So there's a lot of interest. And then there are five youth finalists and there are actually six adult finalists because one of our finalists is actually competing as a duet.
And last year she was the runner up in the adults. So that's
right.
Exciting.
Yeah, that's right. So we're really excited. Shania and Evan are their names, and they'll be performing a duet with the symphony. So
tell us, what's the difference between the youth, what ages that covers versus the adult?
Yeah, the youth division is up until 17, 18, senior in high school. And then the adult division is college and beyond.
And now, do they get the chance to prepare with the orchestra, do like a rehearsal and everything like that?
They do, yes. So first they rehearse with our pianist, Becky Osborne. Then they add the drum set and the guitar. So they slowly kind of add. So it's not kind of all at once. And so they then rehearse with like the small ensemble, and then they get to rehearse with the full orchestra after that. And it's very cool. Tim said that one of his favorite parts, Tim King, former executive director, said that one of his favorite parts was seeing the finalists' faces when they first sing with the orchestra, because it's truly an incredible experience. As a vocalist myself, I know, I remember, you know, it's to be backed up by that many instruments, and it feels incredible. So I'm looking forward to that. Yeah.
I know. And in person, it's overwhelming as well, because not only do you have them live on stage, but you also have the large screen as well. So it
That's
just
right.
adds to the whole experience.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I really commend these young singers, because it's not easy to get up there in front of that many people and with, you know, an orchestra of 40 people behind you. That takes some poise and confidence to do.
To get to that point, you had several judges that do that. Now, do the judges have anything to do, or is it just an audience at that point that gets to vote, or is it a combination?
Correct. It's a completely audience vote. Yes, the judges will be there just as, you know, as guests of the symphony, but their judging duties end with the audition process. So it's 100% audience votes.
And returning as your MC is Jeremiah Mellon, I believe it is?
Yes, yes. Okay. I think that's right. Yes. Yeah, he's a friend of the symphony and an audience favorite.
Excellent.
Yeah, wonderful MC.
Well, this is going to be your first event in the renovated auditorium, where mostly what they've done is done the side seats, which are those old hard seats. So tell us a little bit about that renovation.
That's right. We're very excited, not only about the seats, but about the air conditioning in the venue. September 9th can sometimes be sweaty, you know, first 2 weeks of September are often still quite warm. So they've installed central air in the venue, and then some very lovely padded seats in the balcony. So those hard wooden seats, although they are historic, they were auctioned off. And now people will be in much better, comfortable seats in the balcony.
That sounds great. Well, review real quick for us when Hoosier Star is, and then you got a concert, which we'll come back and visit another spotlight. But tell us about the first concerts that are in the series real quick in our last minute.
Yeah, absolutely. So Hoosier Star is Saturday, September 9th at 7 p.m. at the LaPorte Civic Auditorium. Tickets can be purchased on our website at lcso.net or by calling 219-362-9020. We also have the first subscription concert in our 51st season coming up on November 4th at 7 p.m. also at the LaPorte Civic Auditorium, and that will feature guest artist Sally Koo on violin and guest artist Chester Englander on the cymbalum, which is a Central European dulcimer. And you'll hear some Hungarian dances by Brahms and some other really exciting music. So we really hope to see lots of people there at our concerts and enjoy some beautiful music with us.
Emily Yannis, the executive director for the LaPorte County Symphony, Hoosier Star, coming up September 9th. Thank you for coming on Art on the Air Spotlight.
Thank you,
Emily.
Thanks.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Lakeshore Public Media is brought to you by Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
Hey, this is singer-songwriter from the region, Kevin Friend, and you're listening to Art on the Air at Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Amy Black to Art on the Air. Amy has written her debut novel, Deadly Secrets from Pond Island, a Vanessa Hutchins mystery, under the pen name Olivia Raymond. Amy has had several careers before becoming a successful business entrepreneur. Her various life and career adventures provided her with many experiences that helped shape her stories. She enjoys her time as a writer and volunteer for the arts. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Amy. Hi, nice to see you again.
Hi, Esther and Larry, and thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Oh, we're so glad to have you back from our last time when you were with the Dune Summer Theater, but now you're back here as a standalone author and as Olivia Raymond. So, but just for our audience, we'd like to maybe go back over your personal journey. I always like to see how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about yourself as Amy and Olivia.
Well, Amy has always enjoyed writing, but my writing career sort of took on a business bent throughout my whole profession. And finally, upon retiring and moving back home to Indiana, I decided, you know what, I want to really explore my time as a writer now. So I got a little inspiration and wrote my first novel.
Did you start that novel?
I started it actually last November, and I scratched it out. I called my scratch version rather quickly because I was inspired and it just kept flowing. You know, unfortunately, you can get into that groove and just write. And I did, and I scratched it out and I was all ready to go. And then my author friend, Nikki Long, she goes by, said, no, Amy, hold up, let it marinate. So I let it marinate for a few months and went back to it and then let it marinate again. And so I'd say from start to just now getting my beta copy, it's been about a year.
Tell us some of the inspiration. I know we talked a little bit before the interview started of the story itself, and even tell us maybe a little synopsis of it. And we know later on we're going to have you read a little portion of it, but tell us about the evolution of the story in your novel.
Well, the story was inspired by a true event. I was with my brother who purchased a building in central Indiana, and the building was just filled. It was a huge building. It was filled top floor to bottom floor with just junk. And the realtor, upon closing, asked my brother if he'd like to keep the items that were in the building. And I just involuntarily blurted out, no, because I knew I'd probably be the one helping to clean it out, as I was. And he laughed and he told me a story about when he purchased his building. And he said it was indeed inhabited by a hoarder. And when he was clearing things out, he found a bunch of files from the local police department. And as soon as he said that, just a light bulb went off in my head and my imagination just went wild. And Deadly Secrets from Pond Island were born.
Wow.
Well, the novel, it's you know, the story's protagonist is Vanessa Hutchins. And Vanessa had been a successful criminal defense lawyer for over 25 years. And she's on the brink of being a senior partner when all of a sudden she has an epiphany after visiting a friend who had retired. And that epiphany prompted her to abandon her legal career, buy a house without even looking at it in rural America. And she escaped the city in search of a more meaningful life. You know, she realized, like most of us, were living to work rather than living to live. So her new beginning takes her on an unexpected turn when she discovers that her new home is filled with a hoard of secrets spanning decades. And among the hoard, there she finds some court records surrounding two cases. Vanessa suspects that these cases were hidden on purpose. So she uses her old contacts at the FBI after she digs into them for a while and says, hey, I think I need some help here. I think there's something here. Reluctantly, they spare Agent Will Dudley. And so then Vanessa, during all this, she's made several friends, including Sam, who is a teenager who helped her clean up the mess. Annie Dilks, who's a local business owner. She owns a gym in the area that Annie uses to clean up after her hoard cleaning because she doesn't really have a usable bathroom in her home. And she meets Dave, a town inspector, whom she's nicknamed Dumpster Dave, and Vernon, an old school friend of Annie's. And no one knows about the case files that Annie's found. So that's sort of where the mystery is in the story. And I think one of the interesting things about the story is you don't really know what crime has been committed until the end of the story.
As I was reading it, and because I do know you a little bit, I thought, how much of Amy, or Olivia, is Vanessa. So is there a kind of a relationship there with you yourself? Because you've had a regular career. I don't think it was a legal career. It was more a business, but sort of that. And then, so tell us about that.
Well, I think with any author, you know, there's shades of yourself in probably all the characters. So there's a little bit of me probably in every little one of them. Vanessa does have some similarities with me. She was a businesswoman for many years and really, you know, head first into that career. So in that regard, we were quite similar. Vanessa's a little more impulsive than I am, even though I can be impulsive. She kind of is extremely impulsive. I would never dream to buy a house I hadn't looked at, for instance. But she did, because she just fell in love with it, online photos and things like that. She really wanted to get out of the city. So in that regard, we're different, very different. We both have this bit of an odd sense of humor, which I think comes out in some of the writing and some of the dialogue. So there's a bit of that in there. And other than that, I think she's her own person.
Right. And I love some of the earlier descriptions of the characters, the setting. When I was reading it, I was actually staying in the early part of the thing, because I'm going through this journey of Vanessa and the house and the disappointment and yet the cleaning out and the, almost to the detail of the little cat turds on the stuff. And I mean, and so, but like some of the characters that you have in the book, were these people, and again, I know you can't directly say they were, but are these, with your growing up, this is obvious, I don't know exactly where it's set. It's kind of a generic rural thing, but yes. Were these characters of, like, kind of people that you knew or sketches of people that you knew?
There's only really one character in there who was a person I met when I was 17 years old. And this gentleman was a friend of my father's, but he had had a stroke. And after his stroke, the only thing he could say after that was, "Oh boy." And I remember at that point in the car with my dad thinking, oh my goodness, if I ever write a book someday, I've got to have a character in there named Oh Boy. So yeah. He's probably the only character based off of any semblance of a person out there. Everybody else, and that was the joy of writing. I'm what you call a pantser. I don't really, other than outlining my characters, and I'm pretty diligent about that because I want to make sure they're all different. I write by the seat of my pants. I didn't start out with an outline of the story, where it was going to go. I didn't know what crime would be committed. I didn't know how it would end. But I have a pretty good imagination, and I found that my characters, they just come to life and they take you where they want to go. You might think you're going one way with them and they surprise you. So that's the joy of writing for me.
So in writing Pond Island, were you developing the bones for the second one, because you already have the second one in works? So as you were writing that, did you know where the story was going to go next?
No, and I still don't know, even though I'm partway in through it. And again, I'm expecting my characters, you know, when I get that writer's block and you're looking at that blank screen, it's like, oh my gosh, where are we going to go today? I just kind of start with, well, how's the day begin, or what's the next thing that's going to begin? And then it unfolds for me.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what new townspeople show up in this next novel. Is it going to be based in the same area, can I ask? Or
it will be based in generally the same area, but, you know, in small towns, there's a lot of other small towns within proximity of one another. So this will take place in a different small town called Ravenswood. And it'll be I believe it's Deadly Rumors from Ravenswood.
From Ravenswood.
Yes.
Yeah. Have an idea of how many books you want in the series?
This will have four, is what I'm counting on right now. So you've got Secrets, Rumors, Lies, and Gossip, and they'll all be deadly, Ooh. Of course.
Ah, excellent. So does your growing up in, I won't say a small town, but kind of a rural town, Indiana, give you some basis for what goes on? I mean, then you go off to the big city with your job. I mean, this is your personal thing. Does that give you sort of a background as to, you know, small rural town life?
It did, but also living with parents who grew up in small towns. Obviously, they had small town friends. They had small town beliefs and dogma and all that good stuff. So that kind of stuck with me as I was growing up. And I've always had an affinity towards small towns. I have a sister, and whenever we'd go through a small town, I'd be like, God, this would be a fun town to live in. She's like, ugh, I could never live in a small town. But I find the charm and beauty in small town. It's great. You go to the grocery store, you see people you know. You know, it's not this big, you know, empty world that you're living in.
Right.
Amy, as I looked up Olivia Raymond, I found Olivia Raymond, who writes under the pen name Zelda Knight,
which funny. I thought was
very funny. So can you kind of go through how you became Olivia Raymond?
Well, I have a couple author friends, and they insisted that you'd get a pen name. And that was just that was probably harder for me than writing the book, honestly, because all your life you're defining yourself, you're Amy Black, you know, you're Larry, you're Esther. And then all of a sudden you have to have a new name. Well, that's a whole new identity. So I stressed over what name would I use? First name, last name, middle name, married name, unmarried name, you know, it caused me stress. And then I thought about some of the inspiration from my book and thought about my father, whose name was Raymond Oliver. And I thought, well, let's just twist that name. And I became Olivia Raymond.
It's very sweet.
Yeah, Esther and I were talking before the interview, before you came on. He says, well, actually, your actual name is a pretty good author name. It's a short, you know, it's three syllables, Amy Black, you know. So, but yeah, we were curious about what the origin of the name was. Well, maybe we come to a point that we'd like to share with our audience an excerpt from the book. We've set up a little bit about the background of it. So maybe you can read, you know, a chapter or something from the book.
Sure. And to give you a little background of where we are, because this is midway through the book, give you a little context. Vanessa, the protagonist, has agreed to meet Annie for breakfast. And at this point in the story, Vanessa is highly suspicious of Annie, as she discovered Annie's brother, Ronnie, was a key witness in one of the cases. FBI agent Will Dudley's association as a federal agent at this point is unknown in town. It's a big, you know, Vanessa doesn't want to know she's called in the FBI here. So during breakfast, Vanessa becomes flustered when she learns that Annie knows that Dave, another character in the story, had met Vanessa and Dudley a few days back at another restaurant. He runs into him. Vanessa, when she was introducing the agent to Dumpster Dave, she fumbles over the name because she doesn't know what to say. She doesn't know how to introduce him. So when she's telling Annie about this man she's having breakfast with, she gets all flustered and she doesn't know what name to call him. So she butchers that too. And this is a point in the story where Vanessa and Annie's friendly relationship starts to take a turn as they discuss, especially attitudes between small town living versus big city living. So that's one of the themes that continues to occur throughout the story. And as I'm saying in reading this chapter, I want you to know that on my website, oliviaraymond.com, there is a recipe for these blueberry pancakes I'm about to tell you about.
So sweet. You asked everybody to make them and post a picture for you.
Yes, yes. This is chapter 31, and it's called Pancake Breakfast.
Olivia Raymond's Deadly Secrets from Pond Island.
Vanessa woke in a foul mood. Dudley hadn't phoned the night before as he said he would, which aggravated her. She hated when people said they would call and didn't. She was anxious to tell him about her encounter with Sam at the gas station and that Dumpster Dave was watching her, but it would all have to wait. He was most certainly tied up in his training sessions and she was running late. She needed coffee, but that too would have to wait. She'd overslept again, stacking yet another layer of irritability on top of her foul mood. She would have to hustle if she was going to be on time to meet Annie. She stepped around a panting Walt and patted his head as she hurried to the bathroom, brushed her teeth, and tied her hair up in a bun. She hated feeling rushed, but she had to keep moving fast. She still had to let Walt out for his morning business. As she rushed into the hallway looking for him, she felt a wet squish between her toes. She stopped in her tracks. Looking down, she saw what appeared to be half-eaten kibble mushed between her toes. Oh, Walt, yuck! Her mood sank even further. From down the hall, she spotted Walt looking at her, panting through his innocent smile as he wagged his big tail. Vanessa hobbled to the back door, secured Walt on his long tether and let him out, then hobbled to the bathroom to take a fast shower. Coffee was definitely out of the question now. Vanessa spotted Annie at a corner table, chatting with the waiter. She walked up to the table, looked at the waiter, and grunted, "Coffee, black, please," then moaned a weak "mornin'" to Annie as she took a seat. Her face had a harried look. The waiter smiled as though he was used to serving grumpy morning people. He flipped over the coffee mug in front of Vanessa and filled her cup. She took a sip, sighed with relief, then picked up a plastic menu on the table. "Well, looks like someone woke up on the bitch side of the bed," Annie observed. "What's up with you? Find some disturbing crap?" A shot of nerves shot up Vanessa's spine. She searched Annie's eyes, looking for any hidden meaning to her greeting. "You could say that. I haven't had any coffee yet because I overslept. And while I was rushing around, I stepped in a pile of Walt's puke." "Barefoot?" "Yeah." Vanessa's eyed her menu inside, squished right between my toes. "Ew." Annie crinkled her nose and laughed. "Well, cheer up and put that menu down. I've already ordered us both the blueberry pancake special, and it's on me, so smile," she commanded. Vanessa feigned a smile as she looked at Annie. She didn't know if she was sitting with friend or foe. "Well, now, come on, tell me. What you been up to?" Annie asked. "Oh, you know, still trying to get settled in." "Uh-huh," Annie responded somewhat skeptically. "What?" "I heard you had a beau visit you," Annie smirked as she peered at Vanessa over her coffee mug. Vanessa didn't know how to answer, so she just stared at Annie. Annie gave a sly smile. "Vanessa, you moved to a small town. Better get used to small town living. Besides, I heard he was a hunk." "Now, why would you want to hide that?" Annie raised her eyebrow in jest. Vanessa had to laugh. "I guess it's going to take me a while to get used to people knowing my business." Annie continued to peer at Vanessa over the rim of her coffee mug. "Well, come on now. Don't keep me waiting. I want details." She lowered her voice and in a seductive manner asked, "Is he well hung?" "Oh, Annie," Vanessa acted like a stern matron as she brought her mug up to her lips. "I need to lighten up." She took a sip of coffee, then shot Annie a wink, flashed a coy smile, and replied, "Very." "Now, see there, you're smiling again. So come on now, tell me everything." Annie placed down her mug and wagged her finger at Vanessa. "And don't be leaving out any juicy details." Vanessa concocted a story about a past relationship with Dudley. She said they dated for about a year, but decided they made better friends. In an attempt to add a layer of richness to her story, she took a page from her friend Jessica's handbook. "Dudley's a nice guy and all, but accountants can be so boring. So I fixed him up with a friend, Sarah. I love her dearly, but honestly, she can be a little boring too." She snickered as she brushed off the horrid realization that she'd introduced Dudley as Dave to Dumpster Dave. She took another sip of coffee before continuing her tale, hoping Annie didn't notice her sudden discomfort. "Seems they hit it off. He came here to tell me he's going to propose to her." "Dudley?" Annie looked confused. Another anxious shudder traveled up Vanessa's spine. "What kind of name is Dudley?" "Nickname," Vanessa scrambled for clarification. "He's a goody two-shoes, which explains why he's so boring." Vanessa recalled the accounting firm named Dudley gave to Dave. "His name is Doug, Doug Hodges." Doug Dudley Hodges. Annie tapped a finger to her mouth like she was deep in thought. "Well, he sounds like a real dud. Good thing you pawned him off." Vanessa smiled, but inside she kicked herself. What in the world was wrong with her today? Her dark mood deepened as questions flooded her brain. Did Annie know she'd introduced Dudley as Dave the other day? Was she friends with Dumpster Dave? And where in the heck had she come up with the name Doug? The waiter returned with their food and a coffee refill. Vanessa slathered syrup on her pancakes and took a bite, wanting very much to change the subject. "Oh my gosh, Annie, you weren't kidding," she gushed with all sincerity. "These are delicious." The pancake's edges were crispy, the blueberries were sweet, and the maple syrup warm. She was in taste bud heaven. "Told you," Annie grinned. "Ain't never steered you wrong." "Not yet, you haven't." Vanessa searched Annie's eyes for a moment. She felt a growing air of distrust building between them. Maybe she was being paranoid, or maybe it was her bad mood shadowing the conversation. She took a sip of coffee, then began to bite her nail. "You're a nail biter? Never noticed that before," Annie grimaced. "Ronnie used to do that when he was a kid. That is one bad habit." Annie's harsh words awoke an old familiar feeling of shame inside Vanessa. She lowered her hand as the words stung. "Yeah, it is a disgusting habit," she admitted. "I kicked it once after college, but when I got Walt, it started up again. Took Ronnie years to kick it. I swear he'd gnawed his nails until they were raw and bleeding." "How'd he kick it?" "Picked up a different disgusting habit, which I don't recommend. He took to tobacco chewing. I'd find them gross spit cans all over the garage. Told him if he kept it up, he wouldn't have to wait for his teeth to rot out, because I was going to knock him out first if he didn't quit." Vanessa winced. "That work?" "Eventually. Took more than a couple smacks to his head. He quit just before football season his senior year. Heck, that might have been what thrown him off his game so bad." Vanessa's bad mood emboldened her. She welcomed venturing into this rocky territory. Had to be a hard time for him. "I bet your parents were disappointed." She hoped this would get Annie to share news about her father. "Those days were hard for all of us." Annie's tone had a twinge of heaviness to it. She didn't offer any follow-up. Vanessa wanted Annie to keep opening up, but needed to tread lightly. She pivoted. "So, tell me about Vernon. What's his story?" "Vernon? What do you want to know about him?" Annie frowned. "You're not sweet on him, are you?" Vanessa shrugged and smiled. "Well, he does have nice eyes." "Ha! Nice eyes. Yeah, he's got some nice eyes, all right. Sees a lot more than others, I suppose." Annie didn't know what this meant. She wished she could trust Annie. She wanted to talk without all the code, if indeed they were speaking in code. I'm going to skip a little bit here. So I'm going to just say that this chapter ends with the two of them talking about the differences between old town and small town. And Annie is saying she really thinks it's great growing up in a small town. I won't be able to get into all of it, but it does end on a cliffhanger there where they do talk about just the differences of small town living versus big town living and how each side tends to blame the other for their woes.
And that's kind of the sample of the depth of questions you have in Deadly Secrets from Pond Island, Olivia Raymond's new book and a series. Real quick, when you talked about the series that you're going to develop from this, are you thinking about any other, I know with probably those projects not, but any other topics or any other areas you want to explore? Tell us briefly about that.
Yes, I actually have a story about a venture to space. It's a great human migration to Mars because Earth has become uninhabitable. So a young man is sent to Mars to help get the planet ready for growing trees.
Wow.
And along the adventure, of course, they have trouble with the ship, and there's a big scene, and he's got to survive in space alone for 30 days.
Oh, that's something. Kind of like has a feel of 2001 Space Odyssey, that loneliness that you feel on that. So,
yes, yes.
Well, we have just about a minute left. We want to give you an opportunity to tell us about where they can find Deadly Secrets on Pond Island. I don't know if it's been released yet, and other things, where you can get availability. And are you going to do any speaking or author engagements out in person at libraries and such?
I certainly hope to. I'm going to be looking to find some of those opportunities and get out there with it. The book will be available at the end of this month, and you can go to oliviaraymond.com to learn more. It will be available on Amazon as a self-published author.
Excellent. Any final thoughts that you have for us before we wrap up here?
I just think if you're into mysteries, a good whodunit, this is a nice read.
Well, you appreciate it. That's Olivia Raymond, actually Amy Black, who we've had on before, Deadly Secrets from Pond Island. And you can follow the adventures of Vanessa Hutchins, a formal trial attorney, and how her life is balanced as she goes to a small town living after leaving the big city. Olivia and Amy, thank you so much for coming on Art on the Air.
Amy, so nice to see you.
Esther and Larry, and thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Art on the Air listeners, do you have a suggestion for a possible guest on our show? Whether it's an artist, musician, author, gallery, theater, concert, or some other artistic endeavor that you are aware of, or a topic of interest to our listeners, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
This is Karen Matavia with It's Just Serendipity, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts.
We are pleased to welcome Afi Esse to Art on the Air. Afi is an African-American contemporary realism and figurative narrative artist. She holds a Master of Science in Forensic Psychology with a concentration in art therapy. Afi's work focuses on Black portraiture while representing and venerating West African diasporic history, emphasizing generational trauma and triumph in rural Black America. Afi identifies as a disabled artist who is wheelchair dependent and views artistic ability as a mental skill as much as a physical skill. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Afi. So nice to have you here.
Thank you all for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we really enjoy having you. And our audience is always interested in your personal journey and even your art history. I always like to say how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about yourself.
Well, I am a native Houstonian. I was born in Houston, Texas, but I was raised in between two small towns in Waller County, which is right west of Houston, of Harris County. I have a very long family history in both of these small towns. My mother and father actually met on the one street that runs between their family's property. My history is a little unusual. My family has Native American status by ownership, by slavery. So my family historically was owned by Sioux Native Americans in North Dakota. And a great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather migrated down to Texas and settled in where my family present day is. I have a very long legacy at the at Prairie View A&M University, which is a HBCU here in Texas. My great-grandfather on my father's side actually started the power plant there and was the first engineering professor there. So quite a bit of a lengthy history there. Art has always been a bit of unusual, I guess, talent that's popped up in my family. I do have a great aunt on my mother's side that was a phenomenal painter. But I think I've always kind of just been the black sheep in a lot of different areas of my family's, entire legacy. So the art is, I wish I, could say I, had these great influences and this, long legacy.
But long lineage.
Yeah, but it just didn't. Just kind of sprang up. I just constantly got in trouble for drawing on the walls around the house and on everything. And so when my mother discovered washable markers, she was happy. So yeah, it was a mess. And my mother's disciplinarian, and I have that father that we couldn't do any wrong. So it's like, well, when I'm home with daddy, he doesn't say anything, but then when mama gets home, it's an issue. So it was just always a constant, I'm riding on something, drawing on something, getting in trouble for something. When you got one parent facilitating, the talent, and the other parent that's like, okay, but let's keep it to paper, So yeah, the art, I don't know. I'm sure you guys know how it goes. I think a lot of people still to this day don't really consider being an artist as an actual viable vocation. So, and I'm an 80s baby. I was born in 82. So by the time the 90s came, they pushed college as if you didn't get a college degree, you were going to be flipping burgers somewhere. So off to college I went, and I went to the University of Michigan on a scholarship. I went through 4 years university. I went through 4 years of, I'm sorry, 2 years of graduate school at the University of Houston. And then I went through 2 more years for another master's at HBCU. I wanted to get the very the higher education black experience instead of at a predominantly white university the 2 times before, just to kind of help me be a more well-rounded and prepared person to go out and provide. To he ended up not doing any of that. And I specifically focused on working with children in the forensics arena, usually children who were going through the criminal justice system, mostly children who were perpetrators of some type of crime. My concentration, my license in art therapy is actually on the forensics end. It's not like a therapeutic type of art, though I advocate for that now. But it's like the rest of the example I can give people. It was this one exercise we would do with new clients where we would ask a child to draw their family. Very simple task. And the child is just doing an activity. But what the therapist does is take that drawing and look for clues. You look for, is anyone drawn with bruises? Children tend to do X's, or they'll draw like little bandages. They'll draw bigger people that are scary to them. They'll draw a belt or a stick or a bat or a shoe in someone's hand. And so it gives you a starting point where you can start a conversation with a child that may not be able to or may not be ready to open about some kind of trauma that they're going through. And it's the most ethical way for you to have these sessions with children without leading them. So that's what forensic art therapy is.
Oh, interesting.
It's super, super, super interesting. But art therapy is a very broader umbrella, and that is just purely therapeutic, you know, take my mind off, help ease what I'm going through, relieve stress type of tool. And I advocate that for use with everyone. And the more I advance through my career and my age, I came to use therapeutic art more personally. I have an autoimmune disorder. I have rheumatoid arthritis, and I've had two knee replacements and a total femoral replacement after a knee replacement failed. I also have fused wrists and pins in them, so my wrists do not flex. All of my finger bones are dislocated, but I paint beautifully, and I think that's what the appeal to me as a new contemporary artist is. So I try to use that platform to bring awareness to not only disabled artists, but also anyone who can use art as a therapeutic tool, not just for stress, but I also found that it helps me a lot with occupational therapy.
Yeah, you know, it's a catalyst for so many things, isn't it? It's absolutely a catalyst for conversation and community.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I always work it into my shows. And my last solo that was here in February at the Houston African American Culture and Art Museum, I requested for them to hang the work 6 inches lower since I use a wheelchair. And I know there will also be disabled people that would come to the museum to view. And so I don't want to do a show that's for everyone else. I want to do a show that's for me and what I stand for. And if you happen to enjoy it, that's a bonus. So that's how I try to approach my career as a disabled artist. But getting back to how I got from there to here, I want to say probably the biggest event that happened that got me to art full time professionally was probably breaking my knee. I was doing a mural. I already had rheumatoid arthritis. I had it since 16. I was diagnosed at 16. I'm 41 now. And I was doing a mural maybe 8 years ago now at a small coffee shop and just misstepped off of the small little 4-foot ladder and came down on my knee on a concrete floor and crushed my knee. I had to get a debride. It developed an infection, you know, it was a mess. But I took 6 months off from clinical work to heal, to, you know, have the surgery that should have been 3 months and then back to work, and it turned into an infection. It had to be removed. I had to go a year of antibiotics and an antibiotic spacer, which is like a medicine ball they put in the empty space until you get a replacement. And it turned into me doing consulting work from home. And I was doing art just as therapy for myself, as a anti-depression tool for myself.
So what were those paintings like, or what type of art were you doing while you were healing?
I'm a portrait painter. I've always been drawn to just faces. So just interesting everyday faces. It's like, what's their story? You see someone just walking by, someone sitting at a coffee shop. My thing was scrolling social media and just finding someone that was on following me on social media and just randomly, you know, drawing someone whose face just caught me for some reason. I really don't have a good explanation as to what it is that draws me, but something does. And, you know, I would sketch maybe 3 to 4 times a week for an hour in the morning just to warm up for the day. And it just turned into a thing where people would start following me for to see who was going to get sketched the next day. And and then they started asking to do full commissions. And so that turned into a thing. And it helped not only with my time off from work, it helped compensate income. It helped with therapy. It helped keep my spirits up. And then it came a point where I just could not go back into clinical work and with where what I was formerly doing. So I consulted at home and I did commissions for a couple of years. And then the art kind of took off a bit, and it surpassed my income as a psychotherapist. And so that was pretty much it for clinical work. And here I am.
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, on WVLP, 103.1 FM. Do you ever work, like, from photographs? I know you've said you've taken things off, but like in portraiture, do you do it with sittings, or do you just work from a photograph to create what you do? And you also work in multiple mediums, so talk about that.
Commissions I do straight from the photo. Unless they want something removed or a color changed or something like that. I had this one client who was obsessed with finding old pictures of herself in the Army. And she would be like, oh, can you make my boobs slightly bigger? Can you, like that type of thing. But commissions are straightforward. When I do my personal artwork, I'm a concept artist. So I'd like to pull elements from different inspiring photos. I'll usually scroll, Google or IG, and I'll find some things that catch my eye and interweave them into one painting or drawing. And, there's a story that I'm trying to weave along the way. And I'm not really sure what it is at first. I just know what I like. And I save, all these screenshots and photos all day. And at some point I'll be like, oh, this goes good with whatever I saved last week. I'll remember something and they go well together and I'll end up throwing them in a photo. And that's how I get these paintings that'll have like a Moorish soldier in a 16th century Tudor collar with a pocket right. watch with eggs in his hair. It's like, I pull these things and they're just all symbolic to me for one reason or another, and they make sense to me in the painting, and it's okay if they don't to other people, but it seems other people get it,
I know there's such a luscious look to it. I wanted to know, I've noticed, are the stripes in the background in a lot of your paintings, is that significant in some way to you, the striped background?
The stripes are significant to me for two reasons. For one, I hate backgrounds. But for two, it symbolizes to me this kind of on and off way that I view my work. Sometimes I'm completely in love with it, and sometimes I feel like I'm just picking up a paintbrush for the first time. So the black to white, or the pink to brown, it's just like a repetitive reminder visually for me that it's okay if I feel like I need to stop here, or if I feel like, well, I don't like that, but I'm gonna leave it this time, and next time I'll work more on it. I'll do it better, or So it's just a visual cue to me that, hey, it's okay if you're not feeling this, today, because tomorrow, the next section is gonna be here, and then the next day it's gonna go back to you being okay. So it's just symbolic to me. And like I said, some things don't make sense to everyone else, but these are just little mental cues to myself that as I look around my work, I'm like, okay, I know I felt drained that day when I got to that part. And so that was a small little good enough for me at that moment.
So was there a particular moment that led you to making your own paper for your pastels?
Yes. That's twofold as well. The ridiculous expense of large size pastel paper, and then also the physical therapy involved with making your own sanded paper. It's a layering of, you could layer on paper. I prefer hardboard, it's a layer of paper mache, a lot of glue, a lot of very soft tissue paper. And then the pumice, I make my own pumice ground and with pumice stone and Mod Podge, and make my own solution and layer that on the canvas. I will usually tint it as well. I'll tint the color of the mixture so I don't have to put down an acrylic base layer before I paint on top. And it works for me. I probably estimate if I do something that's like a 30 by 40 size, I probably end up spending maybe $17-$18 on all the material altogether. It's just a way cheaper. If I had bought that somewhere, I would probably end up spending $60 on that same size.
Oh yeah, at least.
Yeah.
There's like, and what about the pastels that you use? Because they just, I mean, I'm just looking at the computer and I could just dive into those colors and the just feel, they look so soft.
Thank you. The face, I do the basic Rembrandt, the new pastels, because I leave the face a bit more looser with scribbles. I have this very scribble type of appearance to my work because of how my hands are formed. I use, when I do work that is blended, which is usually when I do children or a commission, I use custom pastels. I have pastels made by a very talented pastel maker in Croatia, Gordon Bessin. He's excellent, amazing, and he does custom color schemes. So instead of buying a box and you might only need 20 out of this box of 60, it's like you can tell him exactly. You can pick from his archive of the colors that he offers. And maybe 2 months later, you have your custom selection of pastels. And because I'm solely a portrait artist, I don't really use a ton of greens and blues and all these other colors you would get if you were doing a landscape. I don't really use very bright colors, so I can avoid wasting money on these pastels that will sit. I have pastels I've had for 5, 6, 7 years that I've never used because they came in a box with all of the other colors. So it's just it seems like it's a lot of money. It is. They're expensive. But when you boil it down to, well, I'm only paying for what I'm using and not paying for things that I'm wasting, it makes sense. So I love those. And then after that, I like Sennelier. They're a bit way too soft, but I do like them for hair. But I mostly stick with Rembrandt's new pastels, and then I layer the custom pastels on top.
When you approach a piece, I notice you also work in oil and, charcoal. So tell us what makes that decision for you when you're approaching something and say, I'm going to do this pastel oil. So what makes that decision for you?
When it's a commission, the client selects, and it's usually selected by their budget. When I do personal work, a lot of it has to do with how much detail I want in the work and what size I want it. If I want like a concept, a design in my head, and I want it to be large scale, I'm probably going to go with oils just because I can cover way more work faster in a wheelchair with a brush as an oil painter. But pieces that are 24 by 30 and smaller, I do like to go the pastel route, which is probably my first option most of the time. It's just that I think I've mastered pastels in the way that I would like to master them, but not in oil painting. So I'm still learning. I'm still trying to push myself to a level of mastery with oils. I'm still trying to grow with that medium. And I think I've learned everything I could possibly learn about soft pastels. So I think it's just the forever student and do oil paintings, but I don't think it's worth the reward at the end.
Mm. And I've told you this before, but I love the videos that you do of the work in progress. They are just, I find them so delightful to watch, and I've learned so much from them. So I hope you keep adding them occasionally.
Yes. I do. I'm trying to work myself up to being better about additional content aside from just a photo. So they help in that area. But it's like you said, I think it helps a lot of people see the start to finish of the process without having to see all of the fluff stuff in between. You know, so I try to take a picture at the end of every session when I'm working on one of my personal pieces, and then I just weave them together at the end in a video so people can see that I do start from scratch. I start from nothing and get to wherever I'm going, and I can't use the tricks of a projector because I can't stand to trace, you know, and I can't use it. It's so many things that I have to cut out and do the hard way because of the disabilities that I have. And I'm not as vocal about that as I probably should be at this point in my career, but but people see. They see in the photos. They see in the videos. They see that I can't do things as easily as most people. So without me always throwing, you know, my story into someone's face, it's like they get a little hint of it here and there. And it just kind of helps me come out of my shell in that department a little.
And I also wanted to say congratulations on selling a piece before your show opens at the Gallery Guichard. That was, like, wonderful.
Thank you. I think we're on number two now. So,
yay. Before. Oh, no, I did see another one. That's correct.
Yeah. I'm super excited. They're phenomenal. They are a phenomenal team, phenomenal gallery. They're having a phenomenal story themselves in the art world. And so I always seek to work with people who are passionate about art, but not only that, but they do things in a very ethical way, which can be hard sometimes.
And so community, Fran and Andre are just the best, very community spirited and so generous.
They are
with their knowledge.
Well, we have just less than a minute left. We want you to give a chance to how people can locate you online, social media, Facebook, things like that. So tell us all about how people can find you.
My website is afiese.com. You can also find me on IG, afiese art. I'm not very huge on social media outside of those things. You can also go directly to galleryguichard.com or follow on Instagram, Gallery Guichard Social. And they are my representing gallery, so you can always get a hold of me through there. Send me a DM, inbox me, Google me. you'll find it that way.
Well, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air. That's Afi Essay. We appreciate her sharing her art journey with us on Art in the Air. And best of luck with your upcoming show. And thank you for coming on Art in the Air.
Thank you so much.
Yeah,
it's been such a pleasure.
Thank you.
It has been. Thank you so much.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art in the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org, and Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on WDSO 88.3 FM. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operation for Lakeshore Public Media, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And for WVLP, Walt Reitinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts, give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air, our way. Express yourself through and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the